Lifetime of peace, I could handle that. Dom Aylred had not a moment's doubt or confusion. Joe was absolutely right. If he said I was not a monk, then I wasn't. I never had been, nor would I ever be. If I found that hard to accept, yet still aspired to the monastic way, I should act by St. Benedict's most important principle, the glue of monastic life, obedience. Your confessor has told you what your vocation is. Obey him. All said in a loving way, of course, or at least his version of a loving way, which had all the warmth of being kissed by a rather cerebral cod. Age and authority had not softened Dom Aylred. His bluntness exposed another, blunter issue, which Father Joe, in his gentleness, had perhaps avoided. True, the church didn't recognize my marriage. But I'd given my word to another human being, before 100 witnesses on a sunny September day, that I would love and cherish her till death did us part. Supererogation wasn't required by the state of New Jersey, should the parties wish to rescind the arrangement, but perhaps it was required of someone who aspired to the rather higher standards of St. Benedict's rule. The question of my vocation was moot. I'd already made my choice. I slunk back to New York, chastened, and, as ever after a visit to Corps, with far more to contemplate than I'd reckoned on. The bedrock of my great idea had been that my whole life had been tending toward Corps, that Father Joe had been gently leading me back, first to faith, then to my true destination, the cloister, that my monastic vocation had always chafed against the bonds of my marriages, destroying them both. Alas, something else made just as much sense. It was my delusion of a monastic vocation that had chafed against the bonds of marriage, destroying the first and almost destroying the second. Even at my most apostate, I had kept in the back pocket of my soul the idea that I could leave any situation, opt out of any problem. I had a secret escape route, Core. Tony the monk, my alter ego, had been making excuses for and rationalizing my selfishness for 30 years. Because Tony the monk had a higher mission, he didn't have to obey the norms by which ordinary worldly little people lived. Tony the monk had savaged people in writing and in person, careless of the damage, regardless of the consequences, even to himself, because he had contemptus mundi, detachment from the world, and, less loftily, because he could always flee to his sanctuary to escape retribution. Tony the monk was so far above the flimsy moral system of other mortals that he was allowed to commit transgressions with impunity, to treat others, his wives or his children, or friends or enemies, with utter contempt and lack of humanity. He was entitled to, because his heart was pure. The something else that had always lain beside the love Carla and I had together, plotting its murder, that we had never been able to get rid of. Our unwanted partner, our Iago, our unholy spirit, had been, all along, me. Now our marriage could proceed, which it did. As the months crept on, Father Joe's wisdom, like the correct medication for a long misdiagnosed illness, began to have its effect. This isn't to say that our marriage became frictionless, especially given a couple like us. But it no longer had Tony the monk to contend with. It was free to be a contract between a man and a woman, not between a wife and a guy who thought he was the moral superior of a husband. Father Joe had been right, too, about my faith growing and maturing. I could hardly say it was fully Catholic again, though it certainly included a sense of the divine. The spiritual muscles I hadn't used for decades began to acquire some tone, and since they were Catholic muscles, too, it was natural to look for a church to work out in. It was hard. Appalling though the predations exacted on the monastic liturgy were, they were nothing compared to the desecration exacted on the secular. Latin was gone entirely, replaced by dull, oppressive, anchorman English, slavishly translated from its sonorous source, to be as plain and direct as possible. It didn't seem to have occurred to the well-meaning vandals who'd thrown out baby, bath, and bathwater that all ritual is reaching out to the unknowable and can be accomplished only by the non-cognitive, evocation, allusion, metaphor, incantation, the tools of the poet. Mass was now said in the language of the region where it was celebrated. Like politics, all masses were now local and had about as much dignity. Before reform, the individual quirks of the priest, whether he was a saint or a thug, or merely a potato like old Father Bleary, were submerged beneath the timeless rhythms of a universal script. Now, priests had huge discretion in deciding the details of the modern Mass, and all those egos were on parade. At one church I made the mistake of trying, the priest gave a rambling hour-long sermon, whose main function, he seemed to feel, was to keep the faithful rolling in the aisles. Several of the utterly irrelevant observations he worked in were lines stolen verbatim from a Letterman monologue earlier in the week. The music was from one of the new Catholic hymnals, which had replaced the august millennial music of the church, with tuneless drivel penned during the 70s and 80s by clerical non-entities whose musical gods were John Denver and Andrew Lloyd Webber. These were accompanied by a sprightly cacophony of guitar, fiddle, and saxophone. The communion hymn was both better written and more familiar. It was, "Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head." Eventually, I found an exquisite little church just north of Columbia University on 121st Street, called Corpus Christi, run by a dour, ascetic monsignor who had no truck with such liturgical atrocities, preached brief, learned sermons, and every Sunday celebrated a full conventual Mass in Latin with the appropriate Gregorian chant. There were other, subtler bonds to Corpus Christi. Thomas Merton had been baptized a Catholic there in 1938, not long before he went off to become a Trappist monk and live by St. Benedict's rule. And my old pal George Carlin had grown up on the same block in the 1940s, just a couple of buildings from the church doors, no doubt inspiring some of the thoughts that would one day appear on his breakout album, Class Clown. Even if I hadn't found Corpus Christi, I had constructed a means of insulating myself from the hideous practices of the new and improved church. To some degree, in defiance of Father Joe, I'd smuggled out of corps a complete copy of the Offices of the Day in Latin, and said them, most of them, faithfully every day of the week, something I hadn't done since my first year at Cambridge. It was hard to conceal from Carla that I was sneaking off to Mass several times a week. At first I was rather embarrassed about it, having gleefully derided, for most of our life together, such pious practices. To my surprise, she seemed to respect it. However, I did keep from her that I was still nurturing the inner monk. In the circumstances, it felt almost like infidelity. The offices rerouted me in a tradition where, monk or not, I would always be at home. From long ago, I knew the power of their repetition, the incantatory force of the Psalms. But they had an added power now. As a kid, the psalmist, or psalmists, had seemed remote to me. The Psalms' long prayers, which sometimes rose to great poetry, but often had simply to be endured. For a middle-aged man, the psalmist's moods and feelings came alive. One of the voices sounded a lot like a modern New Yorker, me or people I knew, a manic-depressive, type A personality, sometimes up, more often down, sometimes resigned, more often pissed off, railing about his sneaky enemies and feckless friends, always bitching to the Lord about the rotten hand he'd been dealt. That good old changelessness. Quietly but inexorably, calm and happiness began to descend upon our marriage. There was less tension in the air. Things were going so well, we even started fighting a little, just a few tentative jabs, to see how it felt to be swinging at each other again. It felt good. Father Joe had been right yet again. Looking back, I could also see that he had been quite consistent. Even when I was still at school, so certain about entering the monastery, he had gently been nudging me not toward it, but away from it. Those little asides about married couples being just as capable of sanctity as monks or nuns, the observation that Paolo and Francesca were not without hope, the encouragement to go out with a pretty girl, the steady pressure to rescue Judy from her parents and marry her. Now, 25 years, 2 marriages, and 2 children later, I was finally accepting that this was my destiny, that I was called to be a husband. And a father. Another matter. The inchoate sense of responsibility for the death of our tiny sliver of a child still lingered. What if it happened again? What if my seed was toxic? But what if it wasn't? What if it didn't happen again? How wonderful would that be? Wasn't there a certain egotism in thinking it was all my responsibility? Marriage is a partnership, right? It's about more than love. Love doesn't hurt. One sunny August day that summer, while picnicking at the bottom of our garden, lazy with wine and the hot long grass, we conceived a child. We both knew it instantly. It had the exactitude of an annunciation. This time there were no mistakes, no black Sunday mornings, no fear of them even. I knew we were in some way under Father Joe's protection. We had never been happier than while waiting for our baby. The world and life seemed complete and satisfactory and sufficient. I kept stopping in odd places and at odd moments, while I was jogging, or shopping, or shaving, or writing, and trying to remember whether it was okay to be so unambiguously happy. Wasn't there something really shitty I'd forgotten? No, there wasn't. Not this time. Being modern New York parents, we had to know what sex the little sprout was going to be. When the sonogram came in, we were ecstatic. For me, the whole process by now had the awe-inspiring force and momentum of a prophecy coming true. Father Joe had said this path had been chosen for me, and once I'd accepted it, everything he'd always promised would come with it. The joy, the peace, the love had indeed come with it. On top of all that, a son. Being modern New York parents, we also had to name him long before he arrived. Of course, Carla agreed by now, he would be named for Father Joe and Cor. Joseph was not an option, since it was Carla's father's name and so open to ambiguity. I set my heart on Benedict, not just for the obvious reason, but because I truly believed our son to be already blessed. Someone wisely talked me out of this, at least as a first name, pointing out something my British ear was not attuned to. Future school chums would quickly convert this moniker into Bent Dick. We settled on Nicholas and stuck Bent Dick in the middle. And so, in the fullness of time, slightly more than a year after I'd run so bitterly from my old friend, because he'd insisted I was a husband and a father, a son was born. A little golden boy whose hair was already blonde, and whose eyes were as blue as the skies over Cor in spring. Carla had to have a C-section to get him out. They gave him to me in the operating room, with the hospital-issue shawl tight around his tiny body, and I took the sweet bundle over to the soft light they supply for fathers to gaze upon their sweet bundles. And the first thing he did on this earth was to smile at me, who was smiling down at him. Back came flooding those ancient words of Meister Eckhart. When the father laughs at the son, and the son laughs back at the father, that laughter gives pleasure, that pleasure gives joy, that joy gives love, and that love is the Holy Spirit. That winter, my little sister invited us to celebrate a Dickensian Christmas at her farmhouse in Derbyshire with a large number of other family members. Perfect, we thought. His first Christmas in the birthplace of Christmas, and on the feast of St. Nicholas. We flew over in the middle of December to give ourselves time for a trip to the Isle of Wight, where we'd introduce our son to the man but for whom he might not exist. It was a blustery, squally December day, but Father Joe limped out to meet us on the gravel as soon as he heard we'd arrived. Carla handed him the baby, bundled in his snowsuit, little cheeks red as cherries, huge blue eyes staring at this strange being, and sure enough, who wouldn't at a kisser like that, he giggled at him. The joy on the old monk's face, as he gazed back at this little boy, who was just about exactly 80 years his junior, was so simple and intense and pure, it lit up the damp grey air around us. He made a tiny cross on Nick's forehead with his big old thumb, kissed him on his cherry cheek, and, as if he was the most precious thing he'd ever held, hugged him for a full minute. Grandfather Joe. Chapter 18. Sebastian and I hurried up the driveway. Sebastian, a.k.a. Bash, was 7. Unlike Nick, who at 9 was off-the-chart tall and strong, an all-round sports guy who held his own at basketball with the black teenagers in Riverside Park, in fact, was beginning to think he was black, despite his ice-blue eyes and Aryan dream blonde hair, Sebastian was of average height, neat and beautiful, just as blonde and blue-eyed, but definitely from the Italian side of the tree. Not like his big bro, who looked as if he belonged in the bows of a Viking warship. All 3 of them, including little Lucy, who'd soon be 5, were sharp as tacks. But Sebastian was startlingly smart, given to intense quasi-academic crazes. There was usually a pop cultural trigger for these, like a Disney movie, but he'd go way beyond the supporting pseudo-educational promo that showed up on cereal boxes or in Scholastic Magazine or Time for Kids. That wasn't good enough for Bash. He'd plunge into his own research, ransacking the school library and surfing the web for every piece of information he could lay his hands on, and then master it so that he could hold forth to all and sundry. Hercules, which had come out the previous summer, had brought on a craze for Greek gods and goddesses, including all the minor nymphs and muses, many of whom I'd never heard of, and every detail of every legend associated with them. This craze culminated in a terrible, heart-rending scene when Bash suddenly realized that while Mount Olympus existed, the divinities might not, and so he could never, never, ever be a Greek god. In a couple of months, when Mulan appeared, his response would be a burning need to learn Mandarin, which he proceeded to do, setting up his own lessons with the Chinese violin teacher of a friend of his. Soon, reams of paper covered with Chinese characters would litter the apartment, and we'd hear him practicing his sing-song vocabulary for hours in his room. This craze would abate only when he got interested in Japanese and Korean as well, and time just got stretched too thin. Still, he acquired some proficiency in all 3. I was coming home with him one evening in a radio car driven by a stately old Korean gentleman who almost had an accident when Bash asked him something in Korean. They chatted away in Korean for the entire length of West End Avenue, a seraphic smile on the old man's face. "He have really good accent," he said approvingly as we got out. I'd been wanting Father Joe to meet his other grandson for a while, but the demands of school and Carla's job made visits to England difficult. She worked at Ogilvy & Mather now, running the North American arm of its interactive division, and the e-craze was nearing its first alp of incoherent insanity. When we did cross the Atlantic with the kids, it was to go to southwest France, where my little sister now lived in a big old run-down chateau. Not much time remained for other family trips. Then a client meeting in London had come up, and we'd jumped at the opportunity to get a look at Tony Blair's Cool Britannia. It was February 1998. taking Bash along for the ride. Core was a must-do on this visit. In April, it would be Father Joe's 70th jubilee, and celebrations were planned by the monastery to honour his extraordinary 70 years as a Benedictine. I wouldn't be able to attend these festivities, and I wanted to pay my respects individually. I had an ulterior motive. With more than a decade of solo writing under my belt, I felt ready to launch a project I'd had in mind for years, a book with or about Father Joe and our 40-odd years of friendship. I hadn't told him about this on previous visits, and had no idea whether it would be an appropriate thing for a saintly and self-effacing man to undertake. Was there anything in the rule forbidding a project like this? I couldn't recall. Clearly, Saint Benedict had had no qualms about writing books, at least one book. Since my watershed visit of 10 years earlier, I'd been to Core fairly regularly. Core seemed to reach a certain stasis throughout the '90s. It hadn't shrunk too much further, and the liturgical pendulum had begun to swing back a little, toward the Latin. Dom Aylred had died of cancer in 1992, to be replaced by a big, genial fellow named Leo, who also succumbed to cancer a few years later. They were not the only ones. Cancer seemed to be becoming an occupational hazard of contemplative monasticism. Father Joe himself had had another bout in the early 90s, this time a rather unusual form of the sinus, which can be particularly excruciating because of the pressure it puts on the eyeballs, affecting in turn the vision. But if the cancer thought that by attacking him in this unexpected quarter it might get the advantage, it had another thing coming. For the second time, he'd beaten it, and had been in remission for 6 years. Other than his asthma, which he affected never to mind anyway, since it gave him an excuse to go to Italy, he was hale and hearty, and no longer spoke of not making old bones, which would have been meaningless by now, since he would be 90 next year and looked well set to make his century. So it was with a certain excitement that I was coming up the driveway. I knew how much Father Joe adored kids. Bash would definitely make his day. And while I'd learned over 40 years never to assume that I would leave Core with what I came for, I had a good feeling about the book project. It might take a form I could not foresee, would take its own shape, acted on by his great soul. But it was going to happen. A letter from him a couple of weeks before displayed his unchanging, chatty, affectionate self, the writing more spindly but still strong and clear. And I'd spoken to him the night before from London. We communicated mostly by phone now, he having lost all his hesitancy about the newfangled technology. We'd arranged to meet before lunch in his room off the infirmary, overlooking the garden and the sea, where he liked to spend his mornings when it was cold and he couldn't get out. Bash's big eyes were taking everything in, as they had all the way down from London. The Sussex hills, soft and bare in the wintry rain, the ferry pitching in the choppy Solent, cozy inside with the squalls lashing its windows, the apple-green double-deckers that ran on the island, and the always striking neo-Moorish mass of the church and guesthouse, the brooding peace that suffused the place, the sense of home. "Core Abbey," he said, trying out the words. We went into the church for a quick kneel. Stark and silent, free of the visual turmoil of the New York churches Bash knew, with their melodramatic statuary and flamboyant adornment, stained glass churning with figures, 1,000 multicolored stalactites of wax. He said nothing as he gazed into the peaceful gloom, but smiled up at me, as if he got it, understood its appeal. The monastery was quiet and deserted in the middle of the morning, the monks off about their work. The old porter greeted us, knowing that we were here to see Father Joseph, and led us into the cloister without a word, leading us back along one side of it. Bash's eyes were wide now, shining with fascination. His lips slightly parted as he absorbed this very interesting place. I wondered if a new craze might be aborning in his hot young brain. If so, for once, I might actually be able to keep up with him. We went up the stairs to the infirmary, where we were greeted by a lay brother, one of the very few left, named John Bennett. Brother John was a gentle, laconic, solidly working-class guy from Manchester. Over the 15 years or so he'd been at Corps, he'd gravitated to the infirmary, where he was now the infirmarian, or chief medical resource of the monastery, and, willy-nilly, given the shrunken size of the community, its only nurse. He was an unlikely nurse, bulky and muscular, with broad shoulders and features. He had a serenity beyond his years, a certain melancholy. Corps was an aging community, and he had seen much sickness, suffering, and death. He'd nursed Father Joe through his 2 bouts of cancer and most of his other infirmities, and Father Joe loved him dearly. Brother John was a man of very few words. I doubt that in all the time he'd been at Corps, we'd exchanged as many as a dozen. He nodded quietly at us, cracked the tiniest of smiles for Bash, and led us to Father Joe's room, leaving us silently standing inside. I'd been here once before, long ago. It was a rather beautiful room, in the old country house that was here before Corps was built. On the second floor, with a large stone window frame, it overlooked the formal garden behind the monastery, beige and dark grey in the deep of winter. The rain had stopped, but everything was misty and overcast. As ever, off in the distance, heaved the wide, restless moat of the Solent. Father Joe was dozing in a big, ornate chair facing the window, a thick blanket tucked around those knobbly knees. As we approached, he woke slowly with a deep sigh.
"Tony, dear, that must be you."
He turned his head to greet us. He had to make quite an effort. His left eye was sightless, horribly swollen, forced from its socket by internal pressure. The white of the eyeball discolored a gangrenous yellow-green, crisscrossed with broken blood vessels, the pupils staring uselessly off to one side, at nothing. Flashing across my brain came the memory of the terrible epidemic that had ravaged the rabbits when I was a boy, and I would find the poor things in tussocks of grass where they'd crept to die, their staring, swollen eyes forced from their skulls, just like this. I knew what it was, but didn't want to know. Wanted to go back out the door and re-enter, and discover that all was as it had always been. This terrible new knowledge unknown. The cancer had returned. And if he was here, not in the hospital... He pulled his hand from under the blanket and stretched it toward us. His other eye was fine, blinking and twitching out at us as ever. He pushed up his glasses, which had slid down his nose in sleep, and the big mouth bowed upwards in a smile of delighted greeting. But the other eye had its own expression, as if it belonged in quite another skull, staring with infinite sadness and resignation into a void.
"Father Joe, why didn't you... Didn't I tell you, dear? I'm so sorry. I do forget things nowadays."
"Are you going to... Is there much pain?"
"No. The doctor gave me some lovely drugs to keep the pain down. I must say, I rather like the feeling they give."
You're going to get better, Joe. You always have before." Brave sentiments, and not at all what I really meant.
"You can't go, Joe. You've always been here. I need you to be here, always. A world without you is impossible." No, dear, I'm dying. The doctor's quite certain.
I was dumbfounded by my own selfishness, by the void into which I was staring.
This must be Sebastian.
I'd almost forgotten poor Bash. He was rooted to the spot, head down, huge eyes glued on Father Joe from under their finely arched blonde brows. His brave look. He stepped forward, a little hesitant at first, then more certainly, right up to the armchair. Then he leaned forward, trying hard not to look at that awful eye, and kissed Father Joe on the cheek. The look on the old man's face was like a window into heaven. He took Bash into the crook of his arm and held him close. His mouth went into its savoring mode, slowly flexing back and forth, as if my little son's presence was the finest wine he'd ever tasted.
"I've had a visit from an angel."
The door opened. In came Brother John with a tray. On it was some crackers and a brimming glass of red wine.
"Oh, my goodness, this is the best part of the morning. Won't you have a glass, dear?"
I shot Brother John a questioning eyebrow. All right, his flat Mancunian accent made him sound much more severe than he was. But don't forget it's getting on for lunch. You too, Joe. He left. "That's twice as many words as John has spoken to me in all the years he's been at Cor," I said. Father Joe chortled.
"It's wonderful that you could come, dear. I was worried that you might not be able to. I know how busy you are."
He took a healthy hit of the wine and smacked his lips. "Joe, I'd cancel every project I have if my staying here could somehow stop you going."
Don't think of it as going, dear. More that God is coming."
"He is not far off, nor will he be long in coming."
"St. Augustine, how nice that you still remember."
He took my hand. Usually his was enveloping and warm. Now it was chilly. And was that a faint, faint trembling? Bash, perhaps from precocious discretion, more likely from seven-year-old ennui, had moved to the window, engrossed with the shipping on the Solent. There was one question I had to ask. I thought he might find it worldly and faithless, and spoke so softly he had to lean forward. "Do you ever worry, Joe, that there might be just nothing?"
"That's a very good question."
His good eye found my face, the dead one staring off at the hopeless horizon.
"No, dear, that doesn't worry me. I'm a little frightened, perhaps. We always are, aren't we, when we have to open a door that's always been there, but we've never opened."
"Surely you've nothing to be frightened about, Joe, after the life you've lived."
I don't mean quite that, dear, though I am a sinner, and I've often fallen. I mean frightened by the immensity of what lies beyond the door. A God of love, infinite and eternal. How could I ever be worthy of that?"
Yes, it was trembling, delicately but steadily. His hand tightened its grip a little on mine.
"We're nothing, are we, dear, compared to the perfection of what comes next? Death makes failures of us all."
Brother John returned with my wine, the rest of the bottle, in fact. Father Joe's spirits brightened instantly. He had already polished off his first glass. He wasn't supposed to have more, as it would make him sleepy when he had to eat. But no sooner had the infirmarian retired than he almost bounced in his chair with the excitement of getting an extra glass. So there we sat, with the mist-grey winter light of England slipping discreetly through the leaded window, sipping our wine, for all the world as though we were down the pub having a quick one and another rather slower. A simple enough pleasure, one of the best, that I'd shared with countless friends, but never with the most precious friend I'd ever had. The wine wasn't premier cru, core not being in the business of keeping a cellar, and I never drink red in the morning. But its perfume and savour were as delicious as any I'd ever tasted. I stopped looking away from Father Joe's poor dead eye and fixed on his good one, where the life still twitched and blinked. As he slurped happily on his truant glass, I flashed back to that Easter weekend, getting on for half a century ago, when he had described with gleaming Epicurean eye the sumptuous feast the French cooks would be preparing for Easter Sunday.
"And there'll be wine."
If my belief in the God-force principle thing had faltered from time to time, it was completely reaffirmed that morning, when I considered how completely brilliant a creation was fermentation. From decay came a pleasure sublime enough to keep decay at bay. Only for a few minutes, perhaps, but some minutes are like no others. We spoke no more of death. He told me news of Cor, of the fellow monks we both knew, about whom he was as cheeky as ever, about the new abbot who had arrived, an energetic man who was already sprucing the place up, planting new trees to replace those destroyed, making the monastery appealing to new postulants, planning for the future. I told him of my work, which was overwhelming that spring, but included some of the best projects I'd ever worked on. He chuckled about stuff he couldn't possibly grasp, like the backcourt moves Nick was learning, or Lucy's need to get her 5-year-old ears pierced. And then Bash joined in, prattling on with a flood of still more urgent New York matters that were way off Father Joe's linguistic radar, but which delighted him no end, whatever it was all about. There we sat, for the first time and the last. Grandfather, father, and son, until the wine was gone and the lid of his good eye began to droop. A bell tolled. The Angelus, end of the midday office, and notice to all, guests and community, that they should assemble for lunch. The tolling bell on the other side of the monastery sounded far away. The black figures would be leaving the church now, in their double column, the old ones hobbling to keep up, the young ones keeping their pace respectfully slow. Now they had left the church, and were moving along the hushed cloister toward the refectory. Every day, for more than 70 years, Father Joe had made the little trip from prayer to food, two of the very few basics that were the totality of his life. He would never walk even those few yards again. Yet nothing slowed the rhythm of the monastery, quietly, irresistibly flowing on. I got up. Father Joe drew Bash to him and made a little cross on his forehead with a trembling thumb. I knelt down so he wouldn't have to reach up when he did the same to mine. He was so weak, it felt like being stroked with a feather. I took him in my arms and hugged him for a long, long moment. Brother John came quietly through the door to take us down to the midday meal. It was time to go. He looked up at me, his head shaking imperceptibly with the effort. Even his sightless eye seemed full of tears. My own were filling so fast, he looked as if he were underwater, slipping away into the depths. His face creased into one last little smile.
"Goodbye, Tony dear."
"Goodbye, Father Joe." Epilogue. I walk through the drab Victorian streets on a drab Victorian day. All around me, fussing, limping, waddling, whining, are drab retired men and women in sensible cardigans and driving caps. I have chosen to walk the shoreline footpath to Father Joe's grave. It's a couple of miles, but it skirts the worst of the Little Haven, Laburnums, Montney cottages, which are still occupied after a century of relentless ridicule. In fact, have spawned a whole new generation of newer ones just as hideous. The path then runs along the sea west of Ryde, bringing you to the ruins of Old Cor. The truth is that while I'm drawn ineluctably to his grave, I'm apprehensive about what my reaction will be. The longer it takes to get there, the better. 6 months, but the grief is still raw, open to the bone. In the most unlikely places, the dentists, restaurants, creative meetings, sitting on the john, I can still be engulfed by sobs. In public, I have to excuse myself, or pretend something's gone down the wrong pipe. Once, in L.A., a guy actually tried to give me the Heimlich maneuver. I could hardly tell him it was okay, I was only choking on grief. Curiously, it never happens in church. Back in the spring, there had been no question of lingering at Cor. Bash had to be in school, and Carla at work, and our plane left the next morning. Once I might have had the freedom to stay on, but I was a husband and father now. Before we left, I'd asked everyone I knew, Brother John, the guest master, the porter, to let me know if Father Joe began to fail, or when. I could jump on a plane and be at Cor in hours. I gave them all my telephone numbers. In New York, work frenzy hit like a hurricane. Ron Shelton and I had a green-lit movie at Warner's, but the green was rapidly turning to amber as Warner's dissolved into chaos. At the same time, I was planning an article about the last voyage of an 18th-century pirate, which required a 3-week cruise from Nassau to Jamaica via Haiti and Cuba on the oldest wooden boat I could find. I was making all the arrangements. Having heard nothing, I called Cor in early April and was reassured. Joe was hanging in there. He wasn't going to let a little thing like death cheat him of his 70th jubilee, which was to be celebrated on Easter Tuesday, April the 14th, 1998. He would make it. Father Joe had always been a child of Easter, and Easter would bear him up. Could the miracle be happening? Did he have his old opponent in the corner yet a third time? Why not? He'd beaten so many other diseases so often before. I sailed away on my pirate voyage, on a boat so authentically ancient that its captain had no phone. I was incommunicado for weeks. In the few desolate places we made landfall, the phones, if you could find them, were always out of order. In Santiago de Cuba, you could get through to Spain and Poland, but nowhere else. The night I got back from Montego Bay, I was overjoyed. No messages, no letters, nothing at all from Cor. Too late to call there, but what could this be if not good news? A perky voice began to chirp in the back of my mind. He's done it! Just like all the other times. Good old indestructible Joe. I went to bed happier than I had been for months. But he was already dead. He'd made it to his jubilee, though too weak to go downstairs for the ceremonies. His brothers stood in for him. A fellow invalid in the infirmary heard him nonetheless burbling away all day on the mobile phone, until one morning there was only silence. He had passed into an unknowing cloud of pain and drugs, and on April the 27th, 1998, death finally brought him to his knobbly knees. 6 weeks ago. No one had called or even written. Because monks do not live in the world we do, I suppose. Because death is not a disaster, just a door, I suppose. What did reasons matter that morning? I wept and wept and wept, and then wept more. I'd never understood the phrase prostrate with grief, which had always struck me as ridiculously 19th century. Now I got it. I was as weak as you get from a high fever, unable to get up from the floor where I was slumped on my knees, racked by loss. The tears were not all for Joe. They never are. They were mostly for me, that the safety, certainty, the proximity somewhere of him was gone into the darkness. A spiritual fear far worse than the physical, because flight from the physical is always possible, but there is no flight from the terror of drifting untethered through cold cosmic loneliness. So long as Joe was alive in the world, there was a gossamer-thin thread of connection to the possibility of God. But now, selfish as ever. I wasn't thinking how it was for him inside that simple, holy skull. Was he scared? Was the trembling truer than his words? That the 70 years of mortification and deprivation and dedication might all have been in vain? What terror that must be! Suddenly to wonder if faith is rewarded, or whether it's simply its own reward, a pocket watch from management. How I wished I could have been there to hold him as he went. There was no one in the world I would more have wanted to see into the darkness, holding his hand till he slipped from my grasp, and his soul walked away into heaven or oblivion. As if on a leash, I was drawn to the church around the corner from my office on 82nd in Amsterdam, Santissima Trinita. The tears dried up. I sat, I knelt. I shut my eyes, I opened them. The dumb gilt shed was up in its marble cave in the middle of the altar. If there was anyone inside, he had nothing to say to me. At least I had seen him and held him before he died. At least my beautiful little boy had kissed him with love like the grandfather he was to him, and brought the old dampness to his dear, damaged, blood-filled eyes. Father Joe meant God to me more than any of these idealized statues, more than the ugly, overwrought German stained glass, more than any words or beliefs that have echoed round these walls. But some, at least, of these saints were once living people, quirky, lumpy, lovable, who had on those who knew them the same effect Joe had on me. The holy are venerated not simply to get favors, but to maintain beyond death that connection they grant you to the divine, to the better, to whatever that God thing is out there. The God thing is inconceivable without a human body as a medium, something we can cling to, that has touched the inconceivable. My mind wandered over the possibility of praying to Joe, and his personality sprang into my mind, bright and alive, as if he were still present somewhere in the world. This buoyed me, calmed the aftershocks of grief and loss. My God, did I, cynic, skeptic, ex-satirist, card-carrying member of the chattering classes, for whom nothing was ever sacred, finally have a saint? There, in the ugly, peeling church, so far from core, one last time, I sang the Salve Regina for him. The spire sprouts from the trees sooner on the footpath route. It gives me chills. In its shadow lies the little square graveyard, with its plain stone crosses in neat French rows, like a transported patch of Flanders field. I hurry up the driveway, not because I can't wait to get to Core. Core feels alien to me. I'm not sure if it's temporary, vestigial pique at their not telling me of his death, or more permanent. Without Joe, it's of no interest. I go through the big black door that once opened on my secret Eden. No more Eden. The graveyard is only a few yards away now, off the path. But I can't go in. Not yet. I fear his presence will be so strong, I won't be able to stand it. Like the Blessed Sacrament when I was a kid, and it became so present and real, I felt like running from the church. Humankind can only bear so much reality. I hurry on down the great path, through the resplendent sweeping chestnuts, whose autumnal leaves still glow warm brown. Everything dear and familiar is changed. What once was a sure haven is now a landscape of loss, devoid of the spirit which animated it for me. At our favorite spot, the little promontory, still there though each year the sea erodes it farther back into the woods, his image is easier to conjure. The long oval face with its blinking eyes and constant twitching smile, the vast ears, the rabbity triangular nose. Every time I saw Joe, I half expected him to have grown enormous whiskers. He stands there in the eternal wind, hands under scapula for warmth in the chill, flat feet in black socks and floppy asterisk sandals. This cartoon figure, this still center, this rock of the soul, steady and firm as the huge oak that grows from the crest of the hill. Father Joe had one last surprise for me. The first clue came in an obituary a friend sent from England. Apparently, some 200 people had shown up for his requiem. A good rule of thumb for funerals, especially funerals of those whom people love, is that for everyone who does show up, there are half a dozen others who would have liked to. That would put this humble, self-effacing, cloistered monk's circle of acquaintance in four figures. Then, in the same obit, I read these astounding words. He touched the lives of so many people, in England and abroad, in his own church and not. It is hard to give full weight to the extent of his pastoral influence. Father Joe? My Father Joe? I was never so arrogant and self-centered as to imagine I was his only friend and penitent. I knew he had other people who came to him for help, and some old friends, as he called them, especially as he got older. Other monks at Cor had penitents or old friends they were permitted to see. Cor's tolerance of such bonds was greater than that of many other houses or orders. But touched the lives of so many people, which, if you put two and two together, must mean hundreds? I'd always believed, simply on the evidence of his deep love and abiding concern, that what was the defining friendship of my life was also a prominent fixture of his. All great friendships help both parties discover the uniqueness their self possesses, the me they should be. Your true friend joins you on a voyage across the sea of self, whose outcome neither can know as they board, and which will change them both. Common sense suggests it would be hard for one person to maintain in one lifetime more than a few such friendships. It would be taxing physically, the toll it would take on time, energy, patience, concentration, and brutally hard on the emotions, let alone the spirit. Yet, as the tributes came in, and I dug farther, it became clear that Father Joe had undertaken not just a few, or even a few dozen, but hundreds of such life-altering voyages. My ignorance arose partly from living on the wrong side of the Atlantic. His European friends must have been more aware of his relative fame. But that I, a journalist, never got a hint of its extent, says volumes about his humility. Never, in all those years, did he once mention that there were hundreds of other Tonys. Quite unlike most spiritual mentors, who, though they might be deeply spiritual and operate from the loftiest motives, always revel in their centrality to their followers, are always in growth mode, using their success stories as exemplars for new clients. Joe had never cited his success with another old friend as holding a lesson for me. Nor, I'm sure, would he ever have held up any aspect of our friendship as useful or inspiring to another. As far as I could tell, he treated every other member of his huge flock the same way. It was immensely disarming and engaging to be treated as if you were the only one in his life. But then, for the time you were with him, you were. He loved the one he was with, spiritually promiscuous, utterly discreet. One of his fellow monks, when I expressed surprise that I was not the only one, said, "Ah, yes, everyone thought they were Joe's best friend." And all of us were right. We all were. I discovered, as I read more tributes and asked more questions, that he was best known for saving vocations, especially of priests battered by the storms of experimentation and controversy in the post-Vatican II Church. But most of those who came to him were laymen like me, ordinary people in all walks of life, struggling through the world. Many had known him even longer than I had, some for 50 years, some as long as 60. A sizable portion of his ministry was gay, people who'd lost lovers to AIDS, or were grappling with it themselves, as well as those tortured by the Church's relentless intolerance of different sexual orientation, at least among the laity. Perhaps most unusual, a large percentage of his friends were women. I'd seen for myself long ago his sympathy for Lily and her predicament, so it was no surprise to me, though it seemed to be for certain others. Joe never subscribed to the unspoken clerical conviction that women are, for the most part, a large and exceptionally annoying species of chicken. One particular friend was a woman from a city in the north of England whom he called the Mill Girl. She had become a single mother in the 30s, in a time and place when that was a terrible row to hoe, and had somehow gotten to know Joe. He remained her friend well into her 80s. She would spend every summer holiday in the Isle of Wight to be near him. At the other end of the spectrum was a discreet telephone and written correspondence in the mid-90s with Princess Di. Typically, Joe never bothered to share this rather startling intelligence. The seal of the confessional notwithstanding, one would love to know what he had to say about Camilla. Nor was he a chauvinist. He helped many in other churches, notably a man who refers to him as his main spiritual director, Rowan Williams, the dynamic new Archbishop of Canterbury. Archbishop Williams recently said in an interview, "Father Joe was a listener of genius, someone who would be well on the way to meet you before you got there. He immediately flung open the doors. He had huge common sense in his advice on prayer." Joe was a holy chameleon. To me, he was irreverent and secular. To others, he was an intensely spiritual guide. To yet others, a mild but unyielding disciplinarian. To some, he was a father, to some, a mother. He always did what was appropriate and practical for the person he was with. There weren't two kinds of people in the world for Joe, nor 3, nor 10. Just people. He was a prophet of the possible. He soothed the damaged, nurtured the tortured, and reassured the imperfect. My post-mortem discovery of Joe's massive infidelity solved another mystery. Where and how had the innocent savant acquired his vast knowledge of people? And the associated ability never to be shocked or thrown or puzzled by any human behaviour. To some degree, surely, from how much he saw and heard, how many forms and degrees of imperfection he was exposed to. But in the end, his knowledge came from his bottomless supply of love. A poor, bedraggled, overburdened old word, but in Father Joe's hands, revitalized. For Joe, love was a cure, an emollient, a diagnostic tool, a stimulus, a reward, a nutrient, a guarantor of health and peace. He was the living, breathing proof that love will teach you everything you really need to know, even if you choose to live outside the world and its supposedly limitless stocks of knowledge and information. Father Joe was the human incarnation of Blake's vision. You can find eternity in a grain of sand. I take as long as possible to walk back up to the Abbey, still delaying my visit to the graveyard. The autumn nights are drawing in, and the light is fading. The wind is wild in the oaks, whipping the last leaves into a frenzy. They cling to the branches as if they still had some hope. Forget it, leaves. Winter is coming. I must go in. As I pause at the little iron gate, I see there among the rows of plain stone crosses in rows, his cross. They haven't made his stone one yet, so it's of wood, two pieces of 2x4 nailed together at right angles. An already discolored plastic panel is screwed to it. It reads D for Dom, Joseph Warrilow. Then his death date in Roman numerals. Far from an overpowering presence, I feel none at all. I strive to reach him. He seems less alive here than beside the sea where his image was so vivid. Though he is here in front of me, barely 6 months dead, no farther from me than when we talked for the last time, I can't even visualize him beneath the earth, the dear features fading, the poor cancer-battered eyes rotting, the skull within which God surely dwelt, whitening into a death's head. He is here no more. He is elsewhere. He is everywhere.
The end. You've been listening to Father Joe, The Man Who Saved My Soul, by Tony Hendra, narrated by the author.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.